Welcome to the Full Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 10:11 British Summer Time. Today is May 31st. Today being Friday, it's the big picture, long-term audio for the various different asset classes. And if we have a review of what's been happening this week, and in fact, since it's the last day of the month, if we should probably review what's happened this month. And from the beginning of the month, we saw that stock markets were in this really still in a very persistent rally. And in the last week or so, we have had the prospect of mean reversion come back onto the front page. And that is centered around the speculation about exactly what the Fed's intentions are and how is it likely to tailor its actions with regard to its quantitative easing program. And people are now focusing a lot more on individual pieces of data. And the fact that people are wondering about consumer sentiment and consumer spending and the Purchasing Managers Index and what is happening in the housing market, and that each one of these data points is creating a source of anxiety, and then the market is either going up one day and down the next. Well, all of those, when we take them together and we look at where actual people are reacting, it suggests that there is a growing realization that we have been through a remarkable period of persistent rallying in a large number of markets, really since the November lows, and that overbought conditions relative to the 200-day moving average are evident on a significant number of instruments. And at that type of when you've had that kind of persistent rally, the good news has to keep coming in order to convince people that are sitting on the sidelines that now is the time to participate, rather than they may have resisted 2 weeks ago, they may have resisted 3 weeks ago. So the good news has got to keep coming in order to continue to attract new money into the market. And as a market becomes progressively more overextended, then it is expending the amount of available potential demand that's sitting on the sidelines with which to fuel this particular part of the rally. And that then creates the conditions where we can have a reversion once that potential demand has been exhausted. And at present, we're seeing that the S&P's high was at 1684, and it was down 1.43% today, and it's back to 1630. So the bones of a 55-point reaction. And in the course of the last 6 months, it's had four reactions of between 40 and 60 points. So far, this is still within the 60-point range, but it would really need to rally, and rally emphatically, next week in order to maintain that consistency. And if we start to see a larger reaction, then that is going to be at least, that's going to be a pretty good sign that we're back into a position where we could have a larger reaction and a reversionary process back towards the mean. And considering just how much markets have rallied and the anxiety that people are now beginning to express towards the market, then the potential for a pullback and consolidation of what have been incredibly persistent gains has increased. And what was also interesting this week was that some of the shares that have been performing so remarkably well, and the ones that had perhaps some of the largest overextensions relative to their respective trend means, had pulled back by the most. So on the FTSE 100, the asset managers, and actually asset managers were also among the better performers over the last couple of years in the financial sector on Wall Street. And it is interesting that they are now also pulling back. So Franklin Resources was one of the leading decliners on the S&P 500 today. And yesterday it was Aberdeen Asset Management and Hargreaves Lansdown in the UK. And they were also pulling back, having encountered resistance at big round numbers. And at the chart seminar, we refer to these big round numbers as roundophobia levels, because there is such a tendency for markets to encounter resistance and indeed support at these round numbers. Because if you were to ask somebody where they had a target for the market, the chances are that they're going to give you some form of round number. And as markets approach round numbers, they are causes for people to reassess and to look for potential and potentially decide that they need to take some profits. And since this was the last day of the month, and people do have quite significant profits on their books, we have seen some profit taking in here today. I've been talking over the last 10 days about the potential for some rotation in the stock markets, and we are seeing at least some of that in here at present. And in the consumer sector, which dominates the autonomies, and the autonomies are our best bet for the shares that are likely to perform in the next decade. But because they are heavily weighted by the consumer shares, we're seeing that some of them are pulling back in here. Johnson & Johnson is a very good example of something that had broken out of a more than decade-long range, which can be considered a base, and has probably completed a decade-long process of valuation contraction, and had rallied for 18 consecutive weeks until last week, and it encountered resistance at $90 and pulled back fairly sharply in here this week. And that really does suggest that it is going to spend some time consolidating what had been really an incredibly impressive advance. And Procter & Gamble, which had also broken upwards, pulled back pretty sharply in here and is probably going to spend some time ranging in the upper side of this lengthy range. Bristol-Myers Squibb, which had broken upwards and rallied spectacularly in the last month, also encountered some resistance in here today. And if we look at a considerable number of the consumer shares, then it's a pretty similar story, and particularly for those that had really rallied so very impressively and have these overextensions relative to the 200-day moving averages. And one of the things David has mentioned on a number of occasions is that the closest thing we have to a natural law of physics in the markets is mean reversion. And when we see that something has become so very overextended, then the chances are that we are going to see, or the likelihood of a mean reversion relative to the potential for significant additional upside is very much in favor of that mean reversion type activity. And also this week, Japan was really making the headlines. And when we think about what's happening in Japan, well, all of the fundamental case for Japan rallying and for the Japanese stock market to improve hasn't changed at all in the last 10 days. But investor sentiment has. And the Nikkei has pulled back from approximately 16,000 points to approximately 13,500. And it was a little bit firmer in here today, up about 1.37%. But it was down 5% yesterday. So this is a steadying. And what we have seen there as well is that the market had doubled in less than a year and encountered resistance in the region of a round number like 16,000, which represented a doubling, and has pulled back, and some stops have been hit and some leverage has been squeezed out of the system, and people are now starting to think, well, is this now the time to get back in, and are probably looking for some form of confirmation. And Japan is really dependent on economic reforms being instituted. And the market has rallied so spectacularly because of liquidity provision and because of Japan's quantitative easing program. And since that quantitative easing program is really only about 6 months old, and actually less than that, then we're very much in the early stages. And having gone down this path, the Japanese can't roll back now. So they're going to have to continue to print yen. And that looks to be very much the most likely scenario. And when we look at the deterioration in the yen, we've already had a very large deterioration, and the trend remains reasonably consistent. And if we look at it the other way around versus the US dollar, then it's come back to the 100 yen level, which is also a round number, and which should offer an area of support for the dollar. And it is interesting that the dollar was a bit firmer in here today versus a considerable number of currencies, and not least the Australian dollar. And the Australian dollar is a rather interesting example. And what I suppose currencies have been so rangy for the last year that there hasn't really been a great deal to talk about in them, but that is changing really very quickly. Something that has been evident for quite some time is that there is no country is willing to tolerate a strong currency indefinitely. And the most poignant example of that is the yen, where the strength of the currency had become not just an economic liability, but a political liability. And companies like Sony were reporting losses. So that prompted the Japanese to take drastic steps and have announced their quantitative easing. And the Australian dollar has been in the region of parity and between about 96 cents and $1.10 for much of the last 2 years. And when you talk to people from Australia, there isn't a single person won't tell you that there is this dichotomy in the economy between the strength in the commodity sector, and not least in the western half of the country, versus some really very real pain in the manufacturing sector and in anything that's reliant on the domestic economy. And the Royal Bank of Australia has been cutting interest rates, and they're at historically low levels now, in an effort to weaken the currency. And it is back now to 95.71. And I think that's a new low. So we could be in a potential area now where the Australian dollar could be completing a Type 3 top. And in order to question that hypothesis, it would need to rally back above parity. And the New Zealand dollar has also been weaker in here. And the Brazilian real is weaker in here. The South African rand has been particularly weak against the US dollar. So it isn't just the Australian dollar is weaker in here, but a large number of the commodity currencies have been weakening. And it gives us some examples of when a country has a strong currency for a significant period of time, for what kind of challenges that poses, and not least when it is being fueled by the strength of the commodity sector and commodity prices have been fairly weak. If we do start to see the Australian dollar completing a Type 3 top, then one of the things that was really evident in the chart seminar in Sydney 2 years ago was that nobody was even remotely interested in international equities or international investment opportunities, because they were seen to underperform relative to the Australian markets, which have these incredibly high yields, and not least because of the franking system in Australia, and because of the strength of the currency. Well, if the Australian dollar is going to be getting weaker, that situation is likely to change rather drastically. And the appeal of international equities and internationally oriented investment vehicles will improve considerably from the perspective of Australians. So what happens with the currency is likely to have really quite a profound effect on the Australian markets. When we look at the US dollar, and I've posted a chart I haven't been familiar with previously in here today. And it's produced by the Fed, so it's only updated once a month. And the last data point was on the 30th of April. But it shows the US dollar against some of the smaller currencies, but it also includes the Chinese renminbi. So it doesn't include the euro or the yen or the Australian dollar or the pound or the Swiss franc. And we have lots of back history. So we can see that the dollar is weak and has been deteriorating for 10 years. And when we see that something has been deteriorating for 10 years in the commodity markets, or it's in the currency markets, and we know that no country is willing to tolerate a strong currency indefinitely, and we see that it is back to levels that it hasn't been this weak since the commodity bull market of the 1970s. And of course, the other side of that is that commodity currencies haven't been this strong since the commodity bull market of the 1970s. And we start to see that some of these currencies are now starting to weaken. Then it's not such a logical leap to anticipate that we could be in a bottoming out phase for the US dollar. And that could also have really quite profound impact on investor behavior. One of the things that's been evident over the last decade has been that investors in Asia and Latin America have had the double benefit of having not only capital appreciation from the stock market, but also currency appreciation, because they've been investing in areas with particularly strong currencies relative to the US dollar and indeed the euro. So if that situation is beginning to change, then the relative appeal of some of those markets is also likely to change. And that is something that really does need to be taken into account. And whereas over the last decade, people haven't really paid a great deal of attention to the currency adjusted performance, because it was basically taken for granted that the currencies of a number of Asian and Latin American countries would appreciate. I don't think that that can still be said, and that really the currency adjusted performance of stock markets is probably going to become significantly more important over the next decade. Now, if we look at the really the long term, and we think about where are the next really big stories likely to develop, and the rise of the middle class and the minting of up to a billion new consumers in Asia, Latin America, Africa, and the Middle East in the next 10 to 15 years represents massive growth for the consumer sector and for the types of companies that can provide these new consumers with not only their needs but their wants. And that represents a massive shift in the global economy, and the fact that the global economy has not only become more urban than rural in the last few years, but also that the intra-emerging market trade is progressing at a prodigious rate. And the multipolar world that people were talking about a few years ago is very quickly developing, so that the economic centers in the major population centers of the world are going to become progressively more important. And the types of companies that are going to benefit from that and this rise in global trade are going to be truly global companies. And the best way to think about these types of companies is in terms of a country like Venice or Florence in the early modern period, and Venice in particular, where Venice was really quite a small place, but it built an international trading empire which was based on trade and on its individual characteristics as a hub for trade. And when we think about these globally oriented companies, then they've outgrown their domestic markets and various senators and politicians and administrators will tell you that they don't show any loyalty to their domestic countries anymore. But they can increasingly choose where they decide to locate and more where they decide to pay taxes, but also where they decide to open new businesses. And they have incredible expertise in developing new businesses in various countries as they progress up the ladder of per capita consumption. And a number of these companies, they dominate their respective niches, and they have the heft in their balance sheets to be able to grow out those businesses in fast-growing economies. And what country they really consolidate their earnings in isn't really the issue anymore, because these are truly global countries, companies, and they're like little mini mobile countries in many respects. And they represent some of the best opportunities from investors, because while they may not offer loyalty to any particular country, it is their shareholders to whom they are ultimately responsible. And what we are also seeing is that the supplies of these types of companies is actually contracting, because with ultra low interest rates, and large number of them are buying back their own shares and increasing their dividends, so that we're presented with an opportunity where, even though we're now at a juncture where a large number of these types of companies are in a process of mean reversion, so many of them have completed decade-long ranges, and those decade-long ranges were characterized by lengthy periods of valuation contraction and rising dividend yields. In the presentation I created for the Contrary Opinion Forum in Vermont last year, I posted a number of those PE charts, and that presentation is still available in Fuller Money in the presentation section. And you can see that while prices basically went sideways for a large number of these companies, and indeed the S&P 500 and the FTSE and the DAX over the last decade, that the PEs actually deteriorated. And a lot of people, and particularly on the fundamental side, will be looking at history and saying, well, you don't get new bull markets starting when you have valuations in the low teens or even the mid-teens, and that you didn't have the S&P beginning its bull market back in 1982 until valuations were around 7 on a PE. And that's certainly true. But we are currently at a point where equities yield more than bonds and have the capacity to increase their dividends at a rate that's quicker than inflation. So bonds represent particularly bad value at these levels. And yes, valuations are a little bit rich at present. And it is also worth pointing out that the bull market in valuations began in 1982, but the Dow Jones broke above 1,000 for the first time in 1980 and spent much of the next 2 years ranging. And it was that ranging allowed valuations to get down to rock bottom lows. So we do have the capacity over the next year or two for valuations to improve somewhat. I personally believe it is unlikely that we're going to see valuations come right back to the area of 7 and 8 that we had back in 1982, at least not in the absence of quite a significant recession in between now and then. And part of the reason I think that is because there are so many people waiting for it to happen. And when a figure is widely anticipated, people generally initiate their positions before it actually happens. And it's a financial sector example of Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. Basically that the more you know about the position of the particle, the less you know about its velocity, and vice versa. So that brings us to the potential for what is actually going to happen when quantitative easing is removed. And the Fed has told us a lot of things, but mostly what they're telling us is that they're not going to remove the quantitative easing until they have some form of evidence to support the view that growth is on a self-sustaining footing. And we're probably not there yet. Now, the U.S. economy has improved really quite considerably, and there are some quite bright spots, and not least in the energy sector and in the reindustrialization of parts of the U.S. economy, and the fact that the technology sector has the capacity to really produce productivity gains in the next few years, and the medical sector, which is finally coming through with gene therapies, which were promised more than 13 years ago. So we can't rule out the possibility that there are going to be significant productivity gains in the next few years, and indeed over the next decade. And that has the capacity to really create value and support higher prices for equities. But between now and when that actually begins, then we could be in for some rock and roll. And when we look at what's happening in stock markets and we compare it to what's happening in the bond markets, and bond markets look like they are pricing in the tapering of quantitative easing. And if you are heavily long of bonds and you're getting a yield of approximately 2%, and you're looking at that and thinking, well, I don't particularly want to hold my bonds to maturity, because if I hold them to maturity, then yields could be substantially higher than they are now, and I'll take a capital loss on the rollover. Well, then that suggests that my money will not keep pace with inflation, and I need to look at not just the return on my money, but the return of my money. And if equities are really only in a reversionary process, and we are on the cusp of a new bull market in equities, which have been doing not a great deal of anything for much of the last decade, versus bonds, which have been in this remarkably persistent advance for 30 years, then which one is more likely to outperform in the next decade? And the question, well, the answer has definitely got to be the equity markets are more likely to outperform. And if I've got a big long position in bonds, then I've got to be thinking about how I'm going to manage that position. And really, what is going to happen to that position when the momentum fuel that has been added by the Fed is going to be removed? So we're looking at these yields, and they do look like they are basing and potentially completing that base. And that is evidence that people are beginning to look on the bond market as a potential risk. And that money has got to go somewhere. And more likely than not, it is either going to go into very short-dated treasuries or go into something that can hold its value and increase its value at a rate higher than inflation, and that has got to be the higher yielding equities. So if we're in an environment for equity markets where some of the leverage is currently being squeezed out, so on a day like today we saw that commodities were a bit lower and government bonds were a bit lower and equities were a bit lower, and the dollar was a little bit firmer, it suggests that some of the liquidity or some of the leverage in the system was dissipated in here today. And that's consistent with mean reversion and with the reaction and consolidation type environment that we are presented with. And when that clears out, and when people want to think about where they're going to invest their money, then the equity market really does offer a compelling bullish scenario over the next 10-15 years, and bonds represent really quite bad value. And in the commodity markets, we've had really quite a difficult period. And gold, having been so positive yesterday, pulled back sharply in here today. I was back below $1,400. And silver was weaker by 44 cents. And platinum was down by 20. So that has been capped in no uncertain terms. And oil is quite weak in here today. The industrial metals were pretty steady. And that really is a bit of a standout, because the industrial sector has had such a bearish perception about it, and yet we're seeing that the industrial metals are firming. And lumber, which pulled back from $400 to approximately $280 in the last 9 weeks, and on a consecutive week-by-week decline, was limit up the last 2 days. So we're definitely seeing some short covering creeping in that market. And the lumber companies haven't really mirrored the decline in the lumber price, but in the last week they've pulled back right to their 200-day moving averages. And provided they find support here, then their medium-term uptrends will remain reasonably consistent. And in the soft commodity sector, wheat, corn, and soybeans had pulled back sharply earlier this year, but they've all found support. And soybeans in particular is up 14 in here today and is back above the 1500 area. And sugar has been particularly weak and was a little bit weaker in here today, but it is losing downward momentum. And coffee, which has also been particularly weak, is oversold and does look like it is ready for a bounce in here. So we're starting to see a little bit more light and shade in the commodity complex. And that is a change from the very negative perceptions that were being expressed toward it. And when we think about what's actually happening out there in the big commodity consumption demand growth markets, and China is talking about changing the way it is focusing on infrastructure and talking more about cleaning up its environment and supporting its human capital. Well, if China does move towards cleaning up its environment, then that would entail a reduction in steel production. And considering that China has got this massive oversupply of steel, and statistics I heard in the last few years was that it had more spare capacity than the entire steel industries of Japan and Korea put together. So it has got some enormous overcapacity and massive inefficiencies in that market. And if it does rationalize, then that could be a significant boon for a number of international steel providers. And there was also a report we posted in the last week, if not 10 days, from Deutsche Bank, talking about the potential for a quite a significant infrastructure build beginning in India and linked to new railway projects. Now, since India has disappointed just about everybody in every regard with regard to its infrastructure, then we won't have any kind of confirmation that it is actually going to get up and running until we see that some of the track is being laid. But if we assume that it is going to build a new railway infrastructure, that's going to represent a significant demand growth for the commodity complex. And commodities are in need of an additional catalyst for demand growth. And India could potentially be that catalyst. And that would be really very positive indeed, not least for the Indian stock market. So we are living in some incredibly interesting times. And I have to say that I find it very, very exciting. But in the short term, we're presented with a mean reversion. And that mean reversion is going to provide us with the next really very favorable entry opportunity for some of the investments that we really like. And today was also a fairly important day from Fuller Money's perspective. I finished the final draft of my book on behavioral technical analysis and submitted it to my publisher, and they anticipate that we will have the book on shelves, or probably more likely on Amazon, by October or November. And that will be, well, I'll be very glad to see it happen, because it's been a long time in coming. And I think with that, I will leave you for the evening, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.